Voilà.
Perfect. Oh. Fabulous. All right, I'm Paul, I'm an alcoholic. Get a cell phone out of the deal, get some water. I'm good to go. I'm good to go. Like a car, maybe a car afterwards.
Yeah.
That's cool. No, yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for asking me. I think we've been talking about this since March, and now it's June, which just blows my mind. It just reminds me how fast time goes by. And so, yeah, thanks for having me. I love this group. I love the energy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I walk in the door, and I'm just like, you know, with my people. I just love, I love AA. I love all of you. And I don't even know any of you. It doesn't matter, but I do. But, you know, but I do. So, we'll say I have a sobriety date. That's February 23rd of 2008. I will say that that is the only perfect part of my sobriety. I do say that. Say I do believe that God chose that sobriety date for me. Up until that point, I used to choose sobriety dates like it was a hobby. Tomorrow, next year, when I'm 25, when I'm 35, any time but right now was a good time for me to get sober. I could not imagine life without alcohol, you know, and to think that I had to do that was just like, it was too much. So I made a lot of promises, a lot of attempts at getting sober tomorrow and any time but right now. And you'll hear, you know, how God entered my life on that day and how it really wasn't up to me. And thank God it wasn't up to me. So I'm just going to keep on that simple format of what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. You know, I grew up in Los Osos, you know, all the way 30 miles from here. And, you know, grew up in what, you know, people would think was a very normal, cute, you know, very together family. But just as we, like we hear here in Alcoholics Anonymous, we had our secrets, you know, and, you know, I remember from a really, really young age, you know, being around alcohol, and my mom, you know, God love her, you know, she drank very similarly to how I drank. And remember at a really young age, just identifying, seeing that and thinking, you know, I hated it. You know, I hated what alcohol did to her. In turn, I hated what alcohol did to me, our family, and that dynamic. And, you know, I learned from a very young age to shut down, you know, 3-4 years old, you know, vivid memories of, you know, going to a party. You know, if growing up, we played sports and we traveled a lot, but if we weren't traveling, we were at home and we had people over, or we were at other people's houses, and there was always alcohol involved. And, you know, my mom would get really, really drunk, and something would happen. She would either, you know, fall over or just make an ass of herself. Or, you know, I feel like I was the one with the target on me, and she would do or say something, that would just wreck me, you know? And then, you know, we'd wake up the next morning, Saturday or Sunday morning, and I'd just be broken. You know, I just have that feeling of, okay, like what happened? And she would never acknowledge anything. She would never say sorry. If anything, she would just pretend like it didn't exist and then take me shopping and make it okay. That's how she knew how to make things okay. That's how she loved me. She did the best she could, you know, and that was really confusing. So my greatest skill set, you know, as a 3-year-old up until, well, I got sober, was to shut down, you know, and not a great tool, but I did. You know, that's just what I did. And we never talked about feelings, never talked about anything real. We looked good and, you know, we did well. And then we had our secrets, you know, and it was demoralizing. It was really, really demoralizing and scary. And, you know, something that I've had to work through, you know, since getting sober. But, you know, so I knew through my mom's example that I was never going to drink. Ever going to drink. Look at me, you know, obviously that happened, but I was never going to drink. You know, I was a great student. I excelled in school. I excelled in sports. You know, I traveled all over the nation playing basketball. And I had this path that was just paved for me. All I had to do was just, you know, walk down it. And, you know, when I got into middle school, though, that's when things started changing for me. You know, I was, you know, gregarious, you know, popular, had, you know, tons of friends. I was friends with everybody, you know, I loved everybody. People loved me. So I had the the outward appearance of everything was great. But slowly that part of me that just ached, you know, I felt lonely. I was empty. I was insecure, you know, just self-conscious. And I just rarely felt like I fit in, yet I fit in more than anybody else I knew, you know? And when I was at orientation and registration for eighth grade, I went from, you know, one day having this really outwardly normal and fabulous life to, you know, being at registration, and my best friend at the time, you know, pulled me aside there and said, you know what, basically you need to be careful. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, there's this thing called CAP, K-A-P, Kids Against Paula. And I didn't really, I didn't take that too seriously at the time, but I learned to take it very, very seriously moving forward. Because what happened for me is that I went from, you know, having that life that I just described, to being, you know, taunted at school, being, you know, yelled at, you know, down the halls. You know, I'd walk into a classroom and I was just in fear 100% of the time of, you know, who didn't like me now and who was, you know, they had gang signs. I couldn't walk around and feel comfortable in my own skin, you know, when it got to the point where, you know, I didn't know who my friends were. I didn't feel safe. And, you know, there were times where I was eating lunch in the bathroom. I just was trying to hide, you know, from my life and what was going on. I felt that sense of powerlessness. And I hadn't done anything, you know, and it started over this girl who liked this guy that I dated in seventh grade. Big deal, you know? So then I was getting death threats. And I just learned to internalize these things. You're ugly. You're worthless. Die, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what you said became who I was. And already having that skill set of shut down, don't talk about anything, I didn't. So I felt like I was alone. I was a piece of shit. I was worthless. I should die. And I felt that every second that I was, you know, that I was, my eyes were open. And I couldn't really enjoy things anymore. You know, I'd be in the middle of a basketball game, which was like everything to me. And I'd be looking out in the stands, like who's out there, who's watching me, who's, you know, it consumed me. It absolutely consumed me. So when I got into high school, it went from that, you know, 200, 300 students to now 700. And, you know, I had so much trauma that now I entered this larger school and I didn't know who knew, who was going to know these things about me, who was going to think I was worthless. You know, I was consumed with fear and shame. And to say I needed a drink was the understatement of the century. I didn't know that that's what I needed. I needed more than that. But now I wanted to fit in, you know, so badly. So I started going to parties, as we all do. You know, I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be normal. I wanted that life back, you know. And I went to enough parties for a few months to, you know, decline. I didn't drink. And then I went to the party that, that changed my life. And, you know, first time around, bottle of pop-off comes and I'm like, yeah, no thanks. I'm good. Then it comes around again and it was on. And pop-off did for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know. It did everything and then some that I needed, you know. For the first time in a really long time, I was safe. I was okay. I was free. I didn't care what you thought. I wasn't in my head about anything. I wasn't crawling out of my skin. I wasn't wanting to run away. Nothing mattered, you know. All of a sudden, it was fun. You know, I felt like me again, you know, all of a sudden, like, we're all great. I'm hilarious. You know, life was manageable again. And not even was it manageable. It was awesome. You know, I had a ton of fun drinking. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way, I want to welcome you. This is an amazing deal that we have here. And you'll hear in meetings, it was fun with problems, then just problems. And for me, it was fun for about 2 weeks. And then it was fun with problems, you know, immediately. And I was, you know, out the gate, that teenage alcoholic that had the life that could have, you know, taken me to, you know, any school that I wanted for basketball and school. And to, you know, everything that I cared about, family, friends, school, sports, all those things became secondary, if that, you know, those things just went right out the window. And drinking and alcohol became the most important thing in my life, you know. And I remember even, you know, being in a basketball game and then looking out into the stands and, you know, being obsessed, you know. who was here, how was I going to get alcohol, where were we going to drink. Like, I was just obsessed. And that's what my life became about. Not like I would say that out loud, because that's, you know, not really cute for a 15-year-old to be, you know, saying, but that was my reality. Drinking was the most important thing in my life. And so that's how I got through high school. And it's interesting. I just was looking at my high school transcripts, and you can see the progression of alcoholism through high school. You know, up until high school, I got, you know, straight A's, and then freshman year, I'm like, A's, B's, maybe a C, and then sophomore year, I'm like, B's and C's, and then junior, I'm all over the map, you know, because I couldn't do it, you know, I could not do it, and I'm that girl. Maybe some of you are that girl too. You go into a party and you're there, and people are just like, oh Jesus, you know, like, you get that look. You know, I knew that look very, very well. That look immobilized me. You know, it absolutely immobilized me. Because I wanted it to be normal, you know. I wanted it to be very normal. My drinking was far from normal, even from the gate. And, you know, as much as I wanted it to be normal, like I said, it wasn't. And so I got the looks, and people didn't really want me around. So I had to drink to get over that, so then I wouldn't care what people thought. And so that meant I usually pre-partied before I got to the party, would seem normal. Then I'd start drinking. Then I'm blacked out, passed out, urinating. I mean, I'm waking up in bushes. I'm waking up in places that I didn't start my night. You know, I'm waking up in the morning just full of shame. You know, I'm full of so much shame. What did I do? Who did I hurt? Checking my phone. I didn't want to know, but I kind of wanted to know. But then I really, really didn't want to know, because it was never good. You know, it was never good. So needless to say, by the time I graduated high school, I needed to go. I didn't know where I needed to go, but I needed to go. You know, I'm somebody that likes to be 20 miles minimum from my own reality. So, because I can't look at it for what it is. You know, I can't. So the closest or furthest, I guess, I could think to go was I got into Sonoma State up north in Runner Park, which is all of, you know, 5 hours north of here. And a couple weeks before I went up to college, I got my first drunk in public. I was up at the Paso Fair. You know, the evening was supposed to be, you know, seamless, fun, but I drink, so it's never seamless and fun. You know, my parents got us a hotel room, me and a couple girlfriends. We brought a few bottles of God knows what. We're going to, you know, my favorite, you know, band at the time, Maroon 5. We're going to the Maroon 5 concert. We have, you know, front row, center, tickets. And, you know, I didn't even get to see the concert. Probably by the time I got there, you know, eyes roll in the back of my head, can barely even walk. Certainly a vision for everybody, you know, and I'll, you know, I even remember what I was wearing. I just had like this little tank top on, this little skirt. Like, I thought I had it going on, you know? And, you know, within a couple hours I was in cuffs. I don't remember anything, but I can imagine, you know, what it was like, and went to jail for, you know, for drunk in public. And I just played it off like everybody gets drunk in public at the Paso Fair. I mean, I think you guys have a fair here in Santa Maria. Probably people have been arrested here. Everybody gets arrested at the Santa Maria Fair, you know, it's just like, that's just what happens, you know? So my parents and I just really didn't, we just thought, bad luck. And I'm good with that. I'm good with justifying, rationalizing my drinking. You know, like, if only I had eaten a little bit more, or if I was, it doesn't matter. I mean, you name it, I've thought it. It's anything but drinking for me, you know. If I was at a different place, oh God, if I had been there 5 minutes earlier, wouldn't have happened. Or if maybe I did this, I'm just always looking for the perfect combination to make it work. But it was never the drinking. It was wrong place, wrong time, bad luck, ugh, victim, all the time. So then I go up to school, and first night there, you know, break my finger, racing some guy back to the dorm rooms, trip over the curb. Flat, completely flat against my hand. You know, have surgery a couple days later. I get my my first DUI, my second drunk in public. By the way, this is like in 2 weeks. First DUI, second drunk in public. Was kicked out of the, you know, my dorm and put into my own individual dorm with my own RA. I was hospitalized because by that time, you know, I'm 18 years old and I'm emaciated. I'm drinking around the clock. I drink to do anything. I drink to go get food. I drink to go bowling. I drink to go from one dorm room to the other. I just drink. I drink to wake up. I mean, I drink to smoke. It doesn't matter. I just drink. So I'm drinking around the clock. And so I remember coming to in the hospital and, you know, I'm connected to, you know, whatever you're connected to when you end up in the hospital with alcohol poisoning. And, you know, and I think anybody, any normal person who would wake up in the, okay, nobody normal would end up in the hospital with the amount of alcohol that I had consumed. But I would say that anybody normal who maybe accidentally drank too much and ended up in the hospital would wake up that morning and think, oh, geez, Louise, like, this is a problem. I have to do something about that, about this. And that is not what happened for me. My first thought is I need to get out of here as soon as possible, and I need to get back to school doing what I was doing. And that's exactly what I did. In my gown and booties, I hitchhiked from the hospital to Sonoma State, and some lovely gentleman picked me up, God love him, and I, you know, I was back and immediately took to it like nothing happened. You know, again, I don't like to acknowledge my own reality, my own truth. I try to just minimize it and say, not a big deal. Not a big deal. So I got kicked out of school. I want to say maybe like 2 days later. Shocker. I'm a liability, so I've been told. And, you know, I got kicked out, got a letter from the dean of Sonoma State that basically said, Cliff Notes version, hey, Paula, don't come back here. Period. The end. And just like, how dare you do that? You know, I just was, again, I'm such a victim. I don't live on planet Earth with the rest of you. You know, what alcohol does to me is it warps my perception. It takes me from planet Earth and puts me into whatever the heck this is. It's not, we're not one and the same here, you know? So I can't differentiate, you know, right from wrong, good from bad, real from not. I just drink and I just go with it. And so I get this letter, and what do? Maybe a week later, I break into my parents' house and steal the car that I had lost the privilege of driving, like literally broke into their house, you know, broke their, you know, windows, and it's just, you know, bloody mess, and took the car that I lost the privilege to drive and just drove back up there like my friends missed me, you know, like I had friends, by the way, and I got up there and I was arrested that night, shocker, you know, for drunk in public, trespassing, Paula, go, and you know, and I don't think I've been up since, but that's what happens, you know, when I drink, and yet it's not my fault, you know, that police officer, Officer Maggie, had it out for me, you know, I believed that, you know, I actually believed that, and, you know, and so it was just bad luck, and so, you know, with that, with my drinking and that type of thinking, life got really good. You know, alcoholism is a progressive disease, you know, and as much as I wanted it to be normal or work out for me, get better, it was never, ever going to get better, no matter how hard I tried, and I tried really hard. You know, if maybe, you know, if I look a certain way or I hang out with certain people or I have a certain job, like I was employable, if life looked a certain way, then I would be okay. So, you know, I tried this whole school thing, you know, I couldn't really go to Cuesta College, at 8 a.m. sober. So my last day there, I hit a parked car and just went on with my merry way. I knew the girl whose car I hit. And, so I kind of, you know, we good. Dad paid for it. You know, like those are the parents I have. Very enabling, very, very enabling. We know, loved me literally to death. And then, you know, I'd run through jobs. I'm personable. I'm outgoing. I interview really well. I'm a really shitty employee. I show up. I show up drunk. Done that on the first day. Didn't get past the first day. You know, I usually can't keep a job long enough to have references. You know, I would drink on the job. I would leave to go get drunk. I would not come back. Sometimes I would come back. It was always like who knew what was going to happen, and I had tons of jobs just because I can interview well. The follow through though, not so good. So I remember one time I was a what was it, like a cashier at Jiffy Lube. And I thought, I can do that, you know? And I just thought I was going to be like some receptionist or something. No, I like had to wear like the uniform, like the clunky boots. And it was just the craziest thing. So where I met the love of my life, though, he was a lower BATEC. And he was like 21. I was, you know, 19. So that in and of itself is just love, right there. He could give me what I needed. And, you know, I remember one day being at Jiffy Lube and, you know, and I'll go to any lengths to get drunk. You know, I pretend to be on my cell phone, you know, and I'm crying, I'm hysterical. I'm pretending to be on the phone with my mom or somebody, you know, my grandma has cancer, you know, and I'm making up this elaborate story, just so that my boss or somebody can hear me so that I can go and go on with my merry way, you know, about the day. And that's who I am. So great resume. I'm a really, really accountable, gal and very employable, and such a catch to the men, by the way. So I dated this guy, and mind you, you know, my alcoholism at that point had, you know, I was, you know, consumed by alcoholism. You know, it had me by the throat, and I, you know, tried to say it was fun, and it really wasn't. It was, you know, I understand what pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization is all about. And by this time, I was in this relationship with this guy, and, you know, and it went from being controlled by alcohol to being controlled by alcohol and this man. And, you know, I ended up having to get a restraining order against him. And, you know, he showed up at my work one day with a bat, you know, threatening all the guys there. And, you know, and I couldn't get out. I could not get out to save my life. And I mean, literally. So I remember, you know, after the restraining order, which, you know, it's a big deal, you know, pretty big deal. I remember, you know, at this time now I'm not working, shocker. And I'm, you know, it's probably 2:00 in the afternoon and I'm, you know, passed out at my parents' house. And I just feel my phone vibrating and I answer it and, you know, there's Jeff. And I answer the phone and, you know, same thing that I had gotten a million times before. Baby, I'm so sorry, you know, make it up to you. Let me just take you out tonight. And, you know, couldn't say no, you know, and at that point, my parents are doing this thing where mom's on shift half the day, dad's on shift the other half the day. They're babysitting their 19-year-old daughter, 20-year-old daughter, because I cannot be trusted. I cannot be trusted because they didn't know what would happen. And so mom was on shift at that time and he came and picked me up and I just put a little bag together and I remember just walking up the, you know, stairs from, you know, my parents' house. And so, you know, there's a third level. My mom was standing at the top of that set of stairs and I was about to walk out the front door and I just looked up and she said, please don't go. Please don't go. And I basically just, you know, did what I always did. You know, I can't care. I can't care. Can't care about me. I can't care about her. I just basically said, "Screw you. I'm out of here." And that night, I shouldn't have walked out. You know, made it out alive. You know, that night, you know, is where things. You know, like I said, I was controlled by this person. And after that evening, he went to jail and I went to rehab. You know, he went to jail for attempted murder and this laundry list of things and. I needed a vacation, quite frankly. So I went to rehab. I mean, life was really hard, you know, life was really, really hard. And, you know, and I was like, I was such a victim, you know, like, how could this happen to me? And so I went to rehab, you know, and I was there for about, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you buy 1 month, which is like $20,000. And then you get like, you know, maybe, or you buy three and it's literally $1 million. And you get the fourth month free. And my parents are like, well, that's it, steal, you know? And so they shipped me off to rehab down, in Ventura County. And, you know, and I, you know, was getting sober with, you know, Hollywood producers and, you know, people that, you know, were just like me. And, you know, and it wasn't, quite frankly, it wasn't about getting sober. Like I said, I needed a break from life, you know, and that didn't mean that I was going to stay sober and I was, I was going to follow rules and I was not going to drink. And no, I can't not drink and I can't actually follow rules. So I do things my way. And, what did happen for me in rehab though, is that about a month in, I remember being in the cafeteria, the little cafeteria there, and this guy walked in, and he, like Kevin is dressed, he just had this white shirt on, and he had this, silver, chain on, like dog tags, and he just lit up a room, literally, and I thought that about a lot of guys before, but no, this was like, he was so beautiful, and he just had this energy about him that I just was like, wow, and I really got to know this guy. We became just like two peas in a pod, and I learned through this relationship with Taylor, how to love another human being, and how to trust another human being, and how to be loved, and just how to do a relationship. We ended up getting into a relationship. They go well when you're in rehab. But really, he gave me a part of my heart back that I didn't even know I didn't have. I don't know how to describe it, but I learned just how to be comfortable, vulnerable, and honest with another human being. And mind you, I had gone through so many things leading up to that point that I wasn't honest about anything. I was not honest about anything, and he gave me that gift, So we got kicked out of rehab, and then we're going to stay sober together. And you know how that works. We got drunk together. Again, shocker. And I'm an alcoholic. He's an alcoholic. He's also an IV drug user. And I'm, what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous was alcohol, by the way. I didn't do drugs. That's what brought me to my knees. But it got to the point where, we're hanging out and he left me, my heroin using boyfriend left me because I was too much, So that paints the picture for you of what it looked like for me. So, just to backtrack a little bit, clearly I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous because I get arrested, so I've been in and out. I was out, but I was physically in meetings of AA, consuming a seat for about three years before I actually got sober. And I remember my first meeting, this was right after Sonoma State, 7 a.m. at a bank in Los Osos. Mind you, if your intention is not to get sober, 7 a.m. meeting, not the place to be. I had my mom, who was my taxi driver, drive me there. And I just remember sitting in there and just judging the heck out of the meeting and the people. And my alcoholism likes to do, pick out the differences and keep me, again, this far from the truth. I don't look like them. I don't sound like them. I don't this, I don't that. That's not me. It's not that bad. And little did I know that, 3 years later, a lot of those people in that room would be some of my closest friends, And but that's how my mind, that's how this disease works. So, I'm bouncing in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, out of AA, and now after Taylor left me, understandably, now it's just me, and I'm, like I said, I'm around the clock drinker. Now I'm sitting in AA meetings drunk. I'm showing up at your functions drunk. It's bad, and I remember one time being in a meeting, having to get up, go around the corner to the liquor store, buy a 40, pound it just so I could sit back in the meeting and just be, and I held onto the guy's hand next to me and I just was just hysterical. And I just knew that I was never, ever going to be able to get sober. I knew I was never going to be able to get sober because as much as I wanted to at that time, I could not stop. And I never want to forget what that's like to want to stop and not be able to. So, fast forward, to February and, I got through, the end of that year and I had enough guilt and shame now in AA that I couldn't face it. I'm embarrassed. I'm showing up drunk. I don't want to see these people. I feel like you're judging me and blah, blah, blah. This is bullshit. But, so I go down to, Orange County where apparently rich people get sober. I don't know. It's just like, I just had this thing in my mind, like I needed something better, like I thought I knew what I needed. And so I went down to Orange County and went into sober living, and it wasn't about getting sober. It was just about running away from my life again. And what happened for me was 2 weeks into sober living, too long to be away from my life here, you know, in San Luis Obispo. And my last really good drunk plan was to win my ex-boyfriend, an alcoholic. You know, he was getting his 2-year chip on a Friday night meeting in San Luis, and I don't know, win him back. I'm such a catch. 2 weeks sober. And so I get on the train because now I got my second DUI and minor detail. So I've lost the privilege to drive again. So I get on the train. My parents bought me a train ticket. I'm going up to San Luis Obispo. My parents are going to pick me up. Then my friend James is going to pick me up. Then I'm going to go to the meeting and he's going to see me and we're going to... So my plan on the train, now that I'm finally 21 years old, I've been 21 for a month, you know, and I just wanted a beer. I just want a beer. So I get on the train, and my plan was just to have a beer. This is alcoholism to a T. One beer led to two led to three led to Bloody Marys. I'm drinking, you know, best friends with everybody on the train. You know, the bartender's buying me alcohol, the conductor's buying me alcohol. I'm just like, it's a party, you know, best thing ever. And then passed out, blacked out, same dance, different day, you know, same thing. And I was just going to have a beer. So what happened for me is that we pulled into San Luis Obispo. I'm in a complete blackout. And all I remember is just stumbling off the train. And I was just struck sober long enough to, I just looked up and there were my parents and the look on their faces of, oh my God, what are we going to do with you? You know? That wasn't a foreign look for an alcoholic like me. You know, I got that look from everybody, brother, parents, friends, boyfriends, mailman. It didn't matter. I got the look, you know. And for whatever reason, in that moment, the most significant moment of my life, something was different. And I knew in that moment who I was and what I needed to do. And then back in the blackout, I go, you know. And all I remember, oh, by the way, ended up going to the meeting, didn't win him back, so. Came to the next morning, that Saturday morning, and the need to drink was gone. And I say need, you know, if I wasn't drinking, I shook like a leaf, I thought like a crazy person, saw things that didn't exist. It was scary. It was really scary. But that need to drink was gone, and I haven't had a drink since. And that was, you know, over 9 years ago. So, you know, at 21 years old, that's when I got sober. And, you know, to say that I had no clue in the world what to do and how to stay sober, I didn't. I mean, I didn't, obviously. So, you know, my parents put me back on the train that Sunday morning, and, you know, I burned my last bridge. You know, they wanted nothing to do with me. And they had no reason to want anything to do with me, you know. So I went back to Orange County, and I just went to a ton of AA meetings. You know, I just sat my fanny in meetings and not much else. I just sat in meetings and, you know, 3 to 5 every day, 3-ish every day. And, you know, I lived my life in AA just as if I lived my life out, you know, when I was drinking. The only difference is I wasn't drinking, you know, so I wasn't working steps. I didn't have I had a sponsor every other week. And, you know, I do the, unaccountable, you know, sponsor dance where I'd get somebody to sponsor me and then we'd work a step or two and then I'd get uncomfortable because I got to get honest or pretend to get honest and I can't do that. So I just move on to the next and then I get uncomfortable and then I move on to the next and oh God, she's a bitch. So, you know, I just I thought I knew what I needed, right? And so I just did that dance and I was never honest. You know, I had nobody to be accountable to. I was just accountable to myself, really. So, you know, there was a woman that came up to me after a Saturday morning meeting, you know, in Laguna Beach where I used to go to meetings. And she came up to me after that meeting and somebody that at the time I really respected. She had 9 months of sobriety and I wanted what she had. And she said, Paula, pulled me aside after the meeting. Why don't you do something with Alcoholics Anonymous? Why don't you stop chasing around the men? Why don't you go help, you know, be of service, get a sponsor, work the steps? And, you know, the first thought that came to my mind was, she's jealous, you know? And that's my best thinking. You know, that's my best thinking. And she's jealous, yeah, clearly. Little did I know that that was one alcoholic reaching out to another. That was her lending, you know, her hand out, loving me because I was absolutely incapable of loving myself. And that's what we do here, you know, and I thought she's jealous because I was, you know, I had so much to offer AA and the world around me. So, Needless to say, the only thing that happened in Orange County is that I met a lot of wonderful people that I still, you know and love to this day. And I stayed sober. God knows why and how, but I did. And I moved, got back up to San Luis and about 5 months sober and did the same thing. Sat in meetings, met people on surface level and just would keep going to meetings. And what happened for me is I woke up on a Thursday morning, any other Thursday morning. But what was different is that when I woke up that morning, I was in such excruciating pain. I felt like my insides were on fire. You know, I felt so empty. I just thought, oh my God. And that morning I said the first honest prayer I've ever said in my life. I said plenty of prayers. God help me, get me out of this. You know, I'll never do this again. I promise. I was really, really good at making deals with God that way. But this morning it was different and it was, God help me. I can't do this anymore. You know, because I knew what I was getting, you know, by me doing life my way, you know, with untreated alcoholism, not working steps, not doing what we do here. It got me to that place that Thursday morning. And I knew that I would drink. We hear it in meetings every day. I didn't work the steps. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. I drank, you know, duh. And so I found myself calling this woman. I didn't even know who she was. I just had gotten her number the day before, or a few days before, probably maybe a week. Who cares? I got her number. And I called her that morning. I met her the next day. And then my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous began. You know, that woman became my sponsor. That woman became the first woman that I ever trusted in my whole entire life. You know, what I envisioned myself, when I came into AA, I had U-Haul trucks. I had at least two or three coming in behind me with those experiences, you know, the guilt, the shame, the remorse, all of that just packed, top, bottom, side, side. They were just coming in behind me, and I didn't have any idea what to do with that. I had no way to deal with any of it. And the sponsor lovingly helped me just open it up and start just, you know, slowly getting stuff out. And, you know, she would say things to me, like I would share like something, like, I mean, it didn't matter what I'd share something with her that I'd never shared before. And she'd be like, yeah, me too. I'm like, oh my God. And then I shared with her something that I never shared with anybody before. And she said, yeah, me too. And, you know, and we worked the steps. We met weekly. I actually did stuff, which was odd, you know. She taught me how to be somebody that was accountable, somebody that was responsible, somebody that would suit up and show up and go to any lengths for my sobriety. She taught me, Paula, my time is valuable. Don't waste it. Okay, yeah, we good. No, I'll always show up. You know, I didn't know that. You know, I would cancel on people 5 minutes before, like, oh, I'm sick. I've got other plans. Oh, I can't. Something came up. My car broke down. I always made an excuse for why I couldn't show up because I couldn't do this whole relationship thing. You know, people would ask me to lunch or ask me to coffee all the time, and I'd say yes. And I couldn't do it, you know. And then I'd also say no when I should have said yes. And then I would say yes to things when I should have said no. So I had a lot of learning to do. She taught me things called esteemable acts. She said, Paula, if you want self-esteem, which I had none. When I came into AA, I was empty. I was broken. I had nothing. I had nothing. And she taught me the simple things like, Paula, self-esteem comes from doing esteemable acts. And I didn't even know what that meant. You know, I had no idea what that meant. And she taught me how to have a conversation with another person. She taught me how to look other people in the eyes. She taught me how to do two things like, hey, Kevin, how are you? Like, I couldn't, you know, I just didn't know how to do that kind of stuff. She taught me that. You know, she gave me that part of me that that is some of the most valuable, you know, parts of me to this day, you know. And she then taught me how to give it back. So, I'm so grateful for my first sponsor. I'm grateful for all the sponsorship that I've had, you know, in these 9 years of sobriety. And I will put in a huge plug for service. You know, I am my best self. I am the most spiritually fit and connected to my higher power when, well, a couple things. One, when I'm going to meetings. I mean, that's a given. When I'm going to meetings regularly, when I'm connected to another alcoholic or another alcoholics, when I am praying to a higher power that has saved my life over and over and over again, that the steps, I know they were on here, the steps introduced me to. You know, I had no concept of God. My concept of God was, you know, oh God, I had none. You know, God was just like this little thing that me and my brother would like laugh about when we were, you know, at Christmas Eve dinner and my grandma would be praying and just be like, well, you know, like we were just so uncomfortable with the thought of God, that I didn't have God, and I didn't want God. I didn't know that I needed God. I had myself. Thank you very much. And the steps, they're so beautifully designed. They introduced me to a power greater than myself, that I wouldn't be standing up here in front of all of you with the amount of sobriety and everything that I have without that higher power. I'd say that I trust my higher power, 5,000%, and most of the time. Most of the time. And that right there is a miracle in and of itself. Because self-reliance avails me nothing. Side note. Self-reliance avails me nothing. So with reliance on higher power, anything is possible. And not anything is possible in like, Paula, you're going to get the guy and you're going to get the money and you're going to get all those things. Like, no, reliance on God means you're going to do the work and look at all these other things you're going to get. This is what I got. Self-respect, self-esteem, connection with God, connection with others, my family back. I didn't have relationships before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of working the steps, making the amends, I got to give people parts of their heart back. My parents, I remember making amends to them at a year. It was my year sobriety. And they took me out to lunch and I made my amends, and they just sobbed. And they said, we're just so grateful to have our daughter back, because these are people that were up all night, every night, wondering where I was. Is she dead? Is she alive? Where is she? Sending people out to look for me. That's what I did to those people, and the fact that for over nine years, they rested easily, slept well, and don't have to worry about what is Paula doing and what's she going to do. That's enough for me to stay sober right now. That right there. Making amends to my best friends who couldn't be around me anymore because, as one of them said, I couldn't watch you kill yourself anymore, And now I'm a godmother to one of my best friend's daughters, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. So, the service and the spirit of service and the power of service is that not only does it take me out of myself, because I'm in my head. If I'm not getting out of myself, I'm in my head. I think like, I'm appearing like, well, she's got it together. No, I'm fucked up. I obsess about things that really don't matter. I try and control like nobody's business. And then I have a sponsee over and I get to listen to her and I think, oh my God, I'm okay. I'm okay. I remember, doing a fist up with a sponsee and her sharing the darkest part of her that she had never shared with another person. And what an honor. What an honor that was. And I got to do the same exact thing that my sponsor did to me and say, me too. That happened to me too. And that doesn't hold me hostage anymore. I'm a free woman. I'm a free woman because of the steps, because of everything that I've done here in AA. Service, the connections here in Alcoholics Anonymous has enabled me to have the life that I have, which some days seems like a liability. Like my life sometimes seems like this is too much, it's too much in good ways, but also in really stressful kind of ways. I didn't have anything when I came in, and now I have an abundance of things, which is such a quality problem. It's a lot of responsibility. It's sometimes a lot of chaos. Sometimes I just want to run from it. AA's taught me to show up no matter what. It's taught me to, even though your staff is a pain in the ass, you treat them with respect. You listen to them. You get into solution when there's problems. And you just close your mouth sometimes, because sometimes I just want to oh my God, shut the fuck up. That's what I want to do sometimes. And I don't get to do that. I get to be loving when I don't want to be loving. And then I get to vent it to other people. Oh my God, I just can't stand this person. But let me tell you, who I am to them is totally different. And then I can work steps on it. I can do inventory work on it. Like I said, my life here in Alcoholics Anonymous is amazing. And sometimes it takes me getting up in front of, 40 people for me to say it out loud to remember how amazing my life is, because that story, my story, that's maybe 20% of the whole thing, I am a drink to die alcoholic. I am a, things got really, really, really bad, really bad. When somebody comes in at 21 years old, give them a seat, you know, because things were not good. Things were not good. And it's taken me a long time to even get through what I've gotten through and become the woman that I am today, you know, at 9 years sober. And even knowing that I've got a long way to go. I've got a long way to go. You know, this is not over. This is not over. And I'm grateful for that. You know, the underlying, I guess the foundation for me here in Alcoholics Anonymous, or I guess what's the word I'm looking for? We grow or we go, you know. That has been a message that I have seen throughout my sobriety and experienced throughout my sobriety. When I don't want to grow because things are uncomfortable, when I don't want to call my sponsor and say, this is what I did, when I don't want to be honest, I just die inside. You know, I can't even hold on to those things anymore because I know, one, I'll get super uncomfortable, and two, I'll drink. Like, I am as sick as my own secrets. I am absolutely as sick as my own secrets. And, you know, and there's no God in any of that. You know, I can want God's will and not be doing my part and wondering, oh, God, you know, I miss him. It's like, well, Paula, your hands are on the steering wheel. Get in the back seat where you belong, you know. It's God's job. This is God's job. And, you know, and I'm kind of going through that right now where I'm like, I think I'm such a good driver again. And I'm like, here, God, you're like the passenger right now. I got this, you know. We good. We're tight now. I trust you, but I got this, you know. And then shit gets hard, and I'm reminded again, this is God. God, or Paula, get in the back seat. You don't belong there. You do not belong there. All right, thank you. I remember now. So I have to get in so much pain to learn those lessons, you know. I have to get in so much pain to learn those lessons, and that I can come out the other end, laugh at it, and say, oh, yeah, I'm not the ruler of my life, you know. It has to be God. It has to be God, or I will get what we get here, pain or drunk, you know. So I have been really plugged into service here in Alcoholics Anonymous, secretarying meetings, doing coffee stuff, greeter, love the greeter position, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I go in on panels to the prison, and I'll end with this. I started doing that at about 4 years sober, and, you know, we're thinking, what do I have to offer men in blue? You know, like, what do I have to offer men who, what do we even have? I couldn't even imagine my first time, like, walking through the gates. I was scared, you know. I was like, I have no business doing this. I have no business doing this. I have no business doing this. And then I walked into the meeting, and all of a sudden, there were 200 other men that were just like me. It's just like a meeting like this. We are one in the same. We are one in the same. The thing that binds us here is alcoholism. The thing that binds us here is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it is not who you are, you know, anything that has to do with anything but AA and the disease of alcoholism. And I just love the hell out of those men. And anytime I get to go in there, you know, it's like, it's just like hanging out with my buddies. You know, we're talking about life. We're talking about God. We're talking about the steps. We're talking about living life on life's terms. We're talking about steps. We are just doing what we do here. And then I can sit up in front, you know, stand up in front of the room, you know, full of men and say, I am you and you are me, you know, and I love you all. And my heart is just full knowing that I'm not alone anymore, you know, and for that hour or two, they know that they're not alone anymore. And I hope that they know that longer than that stretch of time. But Alcoholics Anonymous has been the best thing that's ever happened to me, you know, and if you're new, I just welcome you. I welcome you to, there is no better place for an alcoholic to be at any time, morning, noon, night, than a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous surrounded by people that are just like me. And, it's a blessing and a freedom to know that I'm not alone anymore. And so if you're new, I welcome you. I hope that you can get even just a little bit that I've got here. It will change you. You know, alcoholism is a thing that took me, you know, away from life. And AA is the very thing that brings me back. And for that, I'm grateful. Thank you.
Participated.